sometimes the lectures will be a little bit technical, and it's sort of easy to lose sight of the goal. So I've decided to use the first lecture to try to give a perspective on how string perturbation theory sits inside string theory, and perhaps how string theory sits inside theoretical physics. Now, my job would be much simpler if I could just stay here and tell you what string theory is. Unfortunately, I don't know, and nobody really knows. So string theory as a whole lacks a non-perturbative description, which is of general validity. We have string perturbation theory, which is a perturbative expansion in some regimes, which is valid in some regimes. We have ADS-CFT, which can provide a non-perturbative definition of string theory in some circumstances. But there is nothing that encompasses the whole of string theory. so this, of course, creates a challenge, not just for this lecture. Now, another challenge is that it's very hard to pinpoint properties of string theory which are of universal validity. String theory is a very, very dynamical theory. A lot of the things that are typically fixed in the theories you usually deal with turn out to be dynamical quantities in string theory. There are no universal constants in string theory. A lot of what you put inside the theory turns out to be dynamical and can change. And unfortunately, it can change to processes which are often non-perturbative, and so they are completely out of our grasp. So that's why it's so difficult to make a specific prediction out of string theory. String theory is a very unique theory, but it has a very rich dynamics. Now, I mean, even very basic statements like string theory is the theory of strings. Well, that has caveats. It starts its life as a theory of strings, then new objects come in. We'll encounter some of them during the course. And strings sometimes can disappear. So string theory might describe a situation where there are no strings. Now, one feature which seems to be true of string theory is that it's a theory of everything, meaning that it's a complete theory. Usually when you have quantum field theory, you can always add some new particles, new interactions, make it part of something bigger. With string theory, the process ends. There is no way to put something new inside string theory, which was not there all along. Now, you might not have known that it was there, but it turns out to be that it was already there. So this is a very nice feature, clearly. It's definitely something we would like to have in the final theory of the universe. But because of this rich structure, it's very difficult to figure out which sort of universe, which sort of everything is described by string theory. Sometimes it feels like a theory is way too much. Because when you do things perturbatively, it looks like all sorts of things could happen. You could possibly get things that look kind of like a universe. You might get it in many different ways. And presumably, a lot of these varieties cut down by non-perturbative effects, but we don't have control on them. So let me try to describe what string perturbation theory is. Usually you encounter perturbation theory when you study quantum field theories, right? Quantum field theories are hard. They're described at least formally by some sort of path integral, typically. So they tell you, okay, you can take some fields, some action, write down some path integral, maybe put in some observables. And this computes something. This defines something in your quantum field theory. But this path integral is very hard. And the simplest thing you can try to do is to do a perturbative expansion of this. So if you have your scattering matrix, say, you can try to expand it in a power series in each bar. This power series is typically not convergent, it's asymptotic. You might quibble on the degree by which this perturbation theory can capture the original theory. On the nose, it doesn't at all. I mean, it's a formal perturbation theory. It doesn't converge. It gives you some good approximation of the two answers. You can start getting into questions of resummations of this perturbative theory, which are occasionally debated about. But the rough idea is that there was something underlying that more or less is well defined, and out of it you extract some perturbation theory. The perturbation theory usually describes, is a good description of the theory, whenever you have some particles which move around almost freely and occasionally interact with each other. So the picture that we associate to perturbation theory is that of particles that move in space-time freely along straight lines, and on occasion they interact at points if your theory is local. So you can imagine defining a perturbation theory by saying, okay, I have these particles, I have these interactions, I start building them up systematically, making sure it remains unitary at every step. Now, in string theory, we don't have anything that looks like this. What we have is a systematic expansion in a systematic perturbative expansion, which is unitary and describes the motion and interactions of objects which are not point-like particles moving space-time, but they are small loops, say closed loops, moving in space-time. So when they move, they look like cylinders in space-time. And then they interact. And the special feature of string theory is that this interaction can be described in a very smooth way. I mean, you could, in principle, add some strange interaction that happens at points, but it's much simpler to just let these tubes reconnect smoothly. Not very good at drawing, but you should just envision these tubes coming together smoothly and separating again. So string perturbation theory is a theory of strings propagating space-time and interacting by reconnection of the loops. Now, I mean, the action when you describe a free particle, you get an action that looks like a relativistic particle. You get an action that looks roughly like this, a mass times the length of the trajectory in space-time. When you describe a string, you can get an action that looks like the area, say, of your string, the area of this object times the tension. So this is something in the unit of mass. This is into a unit of mass squared. So relativistic strings typically come with some intrinsic scale, which sets the scale of the excitations of the string. How much energy do you need to add on a string to a string to make it excited? Now, if you look at a complicated system, a complicated bound system, quantum mechanical system at low energy, typically if it's bound, it looks like a particle. You're studying nuclei, and you're studying at very low energy, they look like a particle, heavy particle moving around. Some excitations of the nucleus just look like different particles, different quantum numbers and different properties, which can be transformed into each other by interacting. In a similar way, if you have a string moving in space-time and you look at it from very far away, very low energy, it will look like a point. The features of this point, the quantum numbers of this point, will depend on what the string is doing in that little space of order string length where the excitations are happening. But at very low energy, the trigger strings becomes a trigger of particles, of many particles. There are infinitely many possible excitations of the string, so we find infinitely many possible particles. But most of these particles will be very heavy. We have a mass which is order of this string scale, multiples of the string scale. So the most interesting question is, what are the particles that you find? What are the light particles? Are there any light particles? In principle, this is not obvious. You could imagine that all the particles that come out of a string will have mass of order string length, and at low energy you'll find nothing. Instead, in relativistic strings, you all essentially always find some light degrees of freedom. In particular, you typically always find the graviton. So one of the low-lying excitations of the string always turns out to be a graviton. So this is one of the striking features of string theory, which is it, or string perturbation theory at least, that it always involves a graviton. So gravity is always somehow part of string theory, at least at the level of perturbation theory. So among the processes described by this perturbative string theory, there will be scattering of gravitons. Another striking feature is that somehow, because the interactions are so smooth, they don't happen at points, but they're spread around, the amplitudes that you compute out of string perturbation theory are finite. There are no UV divergences. There are no issues of infinite renormalization. Now, in quantum field theory, typically there are very few interactions you can turn on that leave the theory renormalizable. If you try to put a graviton in quantum field theory, the theory typically becomes non-renormalizable, which means that it can only be an effective theory, which has to be replaced by something else at some high energy scale. But because string theory is finite, it gives you a perturbative theory of gravity, which is valid, which is intrinsically theory of gravity. Does not have issues of UV divergences. So these are the, so in the next lectures, we'll be able to see why the graviton emerges in string perturbation theory. We'll probably not be able to see much about loop amplitudes. So I will only be able to sketch why string theory is finite. Now, do you have any questions until now? No, I imagined that I had actually put something like this here, and then I didn't. I was trying to draw a diagram which will be a string version of this. But no, you don't need to have holes. So S0 will have contribution from things without holes, S1 from things with one hole, S2 from things with two holes, and so on. The same way as it happens in quantum field theory. So so when you introduce interactions, you soon find a pretty interesting surprise. That is the absence of continuous parameters. So let me be more precise. Suppose you're studying just a single free particle propagating in space-time. Okay. I wrote the action schematically like that, but I could write it a bit more precisely. So this is the length of a trajectory in space-time. The trajectory is parameterized by some parameter of tau. So x mu of tau describes your trajectory in space-time. Now, I can deform this action in many ways. For example, I could say that this particle is propagating in a non-trivial space-time with some interesting metric. So I could replace this eta mu with some g mu. This would be a different theory. I mean, this would be a deformation of the original theory, parameterized by all possible choices of metrics. So instead of one theory, I find a family of theories. Now if you can try to, you can do, surely do the same in string theory. But the funny thing is that we know that string theory has a graviton. And indeed, it turns out that you can mimic the motion in a different metric by just adding a coherent state of gravitons. So you start with, you can start with some reference metric, but then you find that the interactions essentially build up an effective metric in your spacetime out of the graviton field. And this applies to any possible continuous deformation. So you write your most general choices of an action for a string moving in space-time, coupled to whatever fields you can imagine, whatever background you can imagine. And all of these backgrounds turn out to be string modes. So while in quantum field theory, you can define families of theories parametrized by some parameters. When you try to do the same thing in string perturbation theory, these parameters always get coupled to some dynamical fluctuations. And so they really become the expectation value of some fields. So instead of finding big families of string theories, you find just points with a lot of possible dynamical deformations. So for example, if you try to define, so there is a finite list of string perturbation theories which have no tachyons and are that look well defined. The most basic ones are type 2A and type 2B, superstrings, heterotic. Some funny labels, and perhaps a few other variations. All these theories have some features in common. In particular, they have something called supersymmetry. It's not a necessary property of a well-defined string theory. In principle, you can write down string theories which are not supersymmetric. Now, sorry, I should say what supersymmetry is. So supersymmetry is a symmetry which relates the bosons and the fermions of your theory. Now, there are some reasons, which we won't be able to get to, for which balancing the amount of fermions and bosons in a string theory is important to avoid the existence of tachyons. Now, the balance doesn't need to be a perfect balance. If it's perfect, you have a supersymmetry. You can survive with some imperfect balance, which is still allow enough cancellations not to have a tachyon. But it's life becomes harder. So supersymmetry simplifies life in many ways. One of the ways is that it protects, it's one of the few methods that can ensure that the scalar is massless. I said that all the parameters in the theory become fields. That includes the coupling constant. So if your coupling constant is a scalar field, it will get generically, it will get a potential. That potential will tell you that the vacuum, the theory has some vacuum for some value of this coupling constant, which typically has no reason to be close to zero, to be close to one. So you can try to define a non-supersymmetric string theory, but typically you'll find some quantum mechanically, it wants to go at strong coupling, and then it was not a self-consistent definition. For the perturbative string theories, superstring theories, we can at least say that there are self-consistent perturbative expansions because the coupling constant is a field which is massless and can get whatever value it wants. Now, of course, if you want to realize our real world, you need to break supersymmetry somehow, and then you get again into the problem of where are these scalar fields going to end up. But at least for the purpose of defining the perturbative string theory, this is an ideal setup. Any more questions? No, so I really meant H bar, essentially. So see, there are two things. There's a string tension that tells you how heavy are the string excitations. So it's a dimensionful constant. Okay, H bar is also dimensionful, but anyway, the strength of the coupling, the number that you end up putting in front of things with one hole versus things with zero holes, is a pure number, and it's a coupling constant, a string coupling constant. So there are typically two. So when you define the perturbation theory, there are two quantities. One is this string scale, but it's just a scale. It's not a parameter of the theory. It's just the scale at which you're looking at the theory. And then there is the string coupling constant, which is a true parameter, but it's dynamical. Okay. So in this course, we're not going to see very little of superstring theory. We will learn how string perturbation theory works by looking at the bosonic string theory, which is the simplest possible string theory, the one that really is defined by this action without any extra things added on top. It has a tachyon, so it does not describe a self-consistent theory, but at the level of perturbation theory, it works. I mean, at least to give examples of how string perturbation theory works. Superstrings are considerably more technical to define than bosonic strings and require a good amount of knowledge in supersymmetry, which I don't think is available to you at the moment. Okay, so now if this was the end of the story, it would not be so exciting in the sense that you will still have multiple string theories, no idea of how things would look like beyond perturbation theory. Now, so two things come to help. So one is supersymmetry in the sense that supersymmetry protects certain quantities and so allows you sometimes to extrapolate some conclusions beyond perturbation theory. But really crucial is the discovery of D-brains. Now, D-brains are a way to enrich these theories of closed strings. So when I drew this picture, I just drew closed loops propagating around space-time. It's possible to add to the picture open loops, well, open strings, things that will look like a ribbon propagating in space-time. Here my drawing skills really will fail because it's very hard for me to draw a ribbon as something different from a tube. So a ribbon has a boundary, and so typically there will be a boundary in the whole picture. One or more boundaries in the whole picture. Maybe I should draw some simpler things. You could have a ribbon interacting with another ribbon. You could have a tube opening up into a ribbon. This is already trickier to draw. And so on and so forth. Now, when you add open strings, when you add these ribbons, suddenly you have a vast number of choices available to you. Because while the inside of the ribbon is made out of the same stuff which makes the closed strings, the endpoints have extra freedom. They behave much like particles. So when you define a theory, you can make choices. You can say, okay, these ribbons, the endpoints can live wherever they want. Or you could say, no, I want the endpoints to only live on a certain submanifold of space-time. So you could say, no, I want to set a certain place inside space-time, and my the endpoints of my open strings will have to live in that place, even as the closed strings move around freely. You can add many of these places. You say, okay, I want 120 different places where my D-brains, my strings can end with different shapes, different topology, different dimensionality. You could add color to your endpoints of the strings. You could say, oh, I have red endpoints and blue endpoints and green endpoints, and I want to count them all separately. And so on. Plenty of freedom. So all of a sudden, it looks like each of these theories will have countless many descendants where you have enriched them with different D-brains. But now the dynamics of string theory helps you again. All of these choices turn out to be dynamical, not static. So if you tell me that you want the endpoints to end on this submanifold, you will always find some open string mode. It looks like a particle that lives on this manifold, and this causes small fluctuation of the manifold. The position of the manifold was is born as a parameter, but it becomes a field. And so automatically, string perturbation theory tells you that these objects are dynamical objects. They're not some rigid thing you put from outside. Now, the mass of this object is very large when perturbation theory is valid. So if G is the coupling constant, the mass of the tension of this object goes like 1 over G. And so the motion of this object is very slow and only appears order by order in perturbation theory. But they are dynamical. You can even study configurations where you put a brain and its opposite close by, and you discover that as you bring them close, a tachyon appears in the spectrum, which shows you that they are unstable to decay. They can annihilate against each other. If they can annihilate, it means that it must also be possible to create them. So suddenly you discover that these D-brains were not an addition to your theory. They must have been there all along, because they can be created and destroyed. But they really look different from the original strings. They're just new extra degrees of freedom that happen to be very heavy in the regime where the strings were very light and elementary. So, I mean, the fact that you really need to add D-brains in the string theory can be seen also by specific calculations. There are situations where a calculation done using only closed strings will have a singularity, which is canceled by adding D-brains to the story, by allowing the possibility of creating and destroying D-brains, by loops of D-brains, in a sense. So, I think it's fair to say that the way to think about string theory is some theory whose definition is unavailable, which in some regime has a description in terms of a perturbative string theory enriched by dynamical D-brains. Now, D-brains are also very useful to allow you to describe rich, low-energy theories out of string theory. So as I said, closed strings at low energy give you a graviton and a few other fields. But if you put D-brains, you get things like gauge fields. And all of a sudden, you have your graviton, your gauge fields, your field charge under those. You start having all the ingredients that you normally need to build a universe. So D-brains are definitely crucial in almost everything you do with string theory. And they also, I mean, through D-brains, you also get to ADS-CFT. So that will not be covered in this course, which is a very big subject in string theory and beyond string theory. But it allows you to relate string theory and quantum field theories in a surprising way. Now, as I mentioned before, supersymmetry provides a certain degree of protection. It prevents some quantities from getting quantum corrections. In particular, it protects the masses of certain excitations. So you can do the exercise of taking these theories and just listing all the protected quantities, you know, including the masses of D-brains, things like that. And you can ask, okay, they're protected. I know how do they depend on the coupling. How do they look like if the coupling is not infinitesimal, if the coupling becomes large? You look at the list, and the list rearranges itself in very intricate ways. By the time you've got a very strong coupling, you typically end up with somebody else in this list. So people like to draw this picture. A certain number of points, of tips. They say, okay, I have a perturbation theory of type 2A here, type 2B here, maybe some heterotic strings. But if I try to extrapolate it away from weak coupling, I get to the same place. And perhaps I discover new places. Which are not string theories at all. So we don't have a non-perturbative definition of this blob. We only have these perturbative definitions at the corners. And supersymmetry, which allows us to somehow interpolate in for some of the quantities. The fact that all of these arrows and seem to end up at the same place supports our belief that there exists an underlying string theory, whatever that looks like. So this is what this picture is roughly captures what our understanding of what string theory is. As I mentioned, in this course, you only get information about bosonic string, which is another extra corner that doesn't go anywhere. Well, presumably it doesn't go anywhere. As I said, it has a tachyon. You're always free to speculate what happens if the tachyon condenses. What is the end point? I think you can even build models where you have bosonic strings somewhere in your space-time, and you have superstrings somewhere else. And the tachyon here is getting a wave, and then suddenly you find that way, and in between there is something very non-perturbative. So who knows? It's also even possible the bosonic string magically manages to land inside here, but not in a way that we can't control. Okay, so I think this more or less is the picture I would like to convey about what is the role of string perturbation theory inside string theory. Please ask a few questions before we continue. Sure. So now this may require a little bit of supersymmetry, but I can try. But okay, one of the ways this is expressed is that supersymmetry gives a symmetry between bosons and fermions, right? And when you do the calculations with Feynman diagrams, intuitively, bosonic loops contribute to the plus sign, and fermionic loops contribute to the minus sign. This is very hand-wavy, but if your question is sufficiently symmetric, so the things that you're putting in from outside are sufficiently symmetric, then it really turns out that bosonic loops and fermionic loops can cancel each other. And that some quantity simply has no loop corrections. So say if you try to compute the mass of certain particles, the quantum corrections to the mass of certain particles, you try to write your propagator, the classical level, with some loop correction, some more complicated loop corrections, et cetera. And you find that the loop of bosons and the loop of fermions just cancel. Okay, so this is the zero order answer. So sometimes it's only ensured all orders in perturbation theory. Sometimes it can be promoted to a non-perturbative statement. It depends. There are indeed some important examples where this is only a perturbative statement. For example, if you just study some quantum, supersymmetric quantum mechanics, supersymmetric rational quantum mechanics, you might have a potential which, I don't know, has two throats. And, you know, if you do things in perturbation theory, they don't see each other. You find a ground state that sits here and a ground state that sits here, and they're the same energy. If you look and if you allow non-perturbative corrections for instantons, you find that, you know, only you have the difference and the sum of these two with a slightly different energy. Now, another way to understand this this protection is to look at the algebra of supersymmetries. So supersymmetries mix bosons and fermions, so they're sort of strange objects which are fermionic themselves. If you do the commutator, actually the anti-commutator of two supersymmetries, you typically end up with the Hamiltonian. I could have written this just as Q squared equal to H. That would be probably better. That means if you find something, if we find something that is killed by Q, is also killed by H. On the other hand, if you look at some other theories of supersymmetry, you find H plus some other charge. I don't know how to call it. Say the electric charge. You put a minus. So you find something like that. So that tells you that if you have a particle which is killed by Q, which does not have a partner, then the energy is proportional to the charge. The mass is proportional to the charge. And it turns out that a lot of the elementary string modes and a lot of the D-brains are indeed killed by the supercharge, by a supercharge. So their mass is just constrained by their charges. So, you know, if you have an object of charge 1, 1 of charge 2, 1 of charge 3, the mass will be 1, 2, and 3. And this is typically what you can match from different corners of this picture. OK, so perhaps I can use last. It is good. We're going until 11:15. Yes. So can you use the last few minutes to try to sketch what the role of string theory is in high energy theory? So of course, this is a pretty loaded question, and the answer might depend on who you ask. So the explosion of interest in string theory was motivated by the fact it's a theory of everything. So it's a complete theory, and it was the first example of such a theory we ever encountered, the only one we ever encountered. There might be others. It's possible that somewhere in the space of mathematics or physics, I don't know, there is some other blob, probably without supersymmetry, because whenever you put something with supersymmetry, we end up here. And it just waits to be discovered. Every time we try to do something like this, it ends up being connected. Kind of frustrating. For example, through holography, you can, in principle, define a string theory just by giving a quantum field theory with certain properties. And we tried a lot of quantum field theories, but every time we can believe that there is a dual, sorry, I take it back. With holography, you can define the theory of quantum gravity through quantum field theories. But every time we find a quantum field theory which seems to have a theory of quantum gravity behind, it ends up being a string theory or an M theory or whatever, seems to lie inside this blob. These theories typically have in common the fact that they're all supersymmetric theories. Because for supersymmetric theories, we can do calculations more easily. So it's possible that the reason we see only this blob is that it's only the only blob under our lamppost. But it's the only one we have at the moment. It would be great if somebody was to discover something else. It would be absolutely spectacular. Now, in the beginning, the fact that the theory had no coupling constants, no parameters, felt like a great thing. It really means that this is unique theory. It means, okay, we have it, now we can ask, okay, what universe does it describe? If it looks like ours, we're done. Finished with physics, at least with high energy physics. The problem is that it's not only very hard to answer the question, what universe is described by string theory, but it's not clear that this is a unique answer. Because everything is so dynamical, and because our own universe is dynamical, right? We don't live in a universe that existed forever in the present form and will keep going forever in the present form. We live in an expanding universe. It had a kind of a beginning. It looked very different in the past than it looks now. So it becomes even more challenging to figure out what are the possible places a string theory can pass through along a dynamic evolution. So the answer that string theory is giving us when we ask, can we bootstrap ourselves all the way to the Planck scale and find a theory of everything just using the power of our imagination is, well, it tells you, what are your initial conditions? Maybe, your universe might appear dynamically. Something else might appear. It's a bit of a harsh answer. And unfortunately, because almost all our tools are perturbative, it's very hard to explore this dynamic. So there is surely a branch of string theory, which is sort of string phenomenology, tries to figure out what sort of universe you can see, you can get out of string theory. But those are really very lamppost investigations in the sense that we necessarily had to look in the corners in string theory of string theory, which we can control. If you happen to find our universe in one of those corners, well, that's great, but it might just not happen, even if string theory was the theory of our universe. So the situation at the moment for string theory as the theory of our universe is a challenging situation. And it's pretty clear that you cannot really bootstrap yourself. At least it doesn't look like you can bootstrap yourself. You need to keep looking at experiments. You need to keep investigating what they're at higher and higher scales. because even if there could be many, many different possibilities which are governed by the same underlying theory. And on the other hand, it's clearly also we need to know a lot more about string theory. We need to find ways to explore more of this big blob. Or to find other blobs. That would be also great. Now, string theory has other uses besides the theory of everything. So I mentioned holography. There is this deep relation between strongly coupled quantum field theories and quantum gravity and string theory, which means that you can use string theory to study strongly coupled quantum field theories, which are very interesting and very hard objects to put your hands on. It is in the context of, especially in the context of supersymmetry, string theory has been a very powerful source of truths about quantum field theory. Somehow, there are a lot of situations where you can build up some gadget in string theory, which at low energy looks like a quantum field theory. And then you can use some dualities of string theory to convert it into some other gadget, which looks like a different quantum field theory, and discover that these quantum field theories are actually the same or related. So all these dualities of the string theory have been used to derive dualities and properties of supersymmetric gauge theories. Properties which sometimes can be proven afterwards with different means, and sometimes cannot, at least for now. So string theory has been a source of information and truths about quantum field theory. And it also has a similar relation with math. String theory has an habit of producing mathematical truths or conjectures, which can then be possibly proven mathematically, independently from string theory. So it gave rise to branches of math such as mirror symmetry. And of course, the hope is that this communication channel will go both ways. At some point, the mathematicians might be able to help us figure out what they did. A lot in the future. For now, we're still trying to figure out what quantum field theories are, but you know, in time. So this is the situation. This is the best of my knowledge. Any more questions for the last 5 minutes?
When you described how the metric changes in string theory as because of coherent states of gravitons, you start with the background metric.
Yes.
There, right? Don't you get different theories if you start with different background metrics?
So you get the different expansions of the same theory. So suppose you have a quantum field theory. Right? I drew something. Some very simple quantum field theory, a scalar field theory with a potential that looks like that. You could choose to make perturbative expansion around this vacuum or to do perturbative expansion around this vacuum. How would you know if you're sitting here that this vacuum exists? Well, you're going to compute the effective potential ordered by ordering perturbation theory. And you are going to build it as a coherent state of the excitations of the scalar field around this vacuum. Now, the peculiarity of string theory is that here in quantum field theory, you had to start with the scalar field as a dynamical object. But in string theory, sometimes you start with the ground, and then it becomes dynamic. So in quantum field theory, if you didn't put a scalar field to start with, you wouldn't get a picture. Come on, 3 more minutes. Okay. Now. Well, you can have processes where just two open strings convert into a closed string, or a closed string decomposing two open strings. But the way they're defined separately. Well, it just it's much of a matter of how you cut this picture. Now, you can take the same picture. Hide the chalks. Okay. So you can take a situation like this, where your 2D brain say, you can draw a picture like in space time that looks like this. Okay. If you cut it like this, this looks like a closed string, an off-shell closed string that is just going from one, being exchanged from one D brain to the other. If you cut it like this, it will look like a loop of open strings. Now, perhaps we say something about textbooks, or I learned string theory from the Polchinski, which has an excellent description of perturbative perturbation theory. There are other textbooks out there. They might be better or worse. I'm not sure because I didn't use them. When you learn from the Polchinski, sometimes it's useful to have a separate reference from conformal field theory, although Polchinski treats it quite well. Something like the yellow book, the Di Francesco on conformal field theory. But so in the lectures, I'll try not to use conformal field theory at all. To do everything with free field theory, and but it's useful if you, as you learn it by yourself, to test some conformal field theory.
In what sense do you think that non-perturbative effects are understood in quantum
physics? Well, the study is perhaps a big word. I mean, at least they're in principle defined. So the path integral can be, it's in principle a well-defined object. It might be very difficult to do calculations with it, but in principle you could discretize, put it on the lattice, use heavy-duty numerics. In string theory, you just don't have even a definition of what a perturbative calculation would look like. And we know that perturbation theory can be very deceptive even in a quantum field theory. So if you look at QED, Supermeier Mills, right? Perturbation theory tells a story of gluons and quarks that are scattering from each other, and interactions that become somehow stronger as distances increase. But you will never be able to get out of perturbation theory the existence of a proton or a neutron or nuclear physics. And that should make you very worried about string theory, right? Once you start breaking supersymmetry and what's going to happen? A difficult question.
In all of this, are we imagining that there's a covert space with quantum states when we're talking about the string world?
Well, in perturbation theory, sure. Non-perturbative, you get into quantum gravity, and the honest answer would be I don't know. In some circumstances, like when ADS-CFT is applicable, there is definitely a Hilbert space. I think we generally believe that, yes, the standard rules of quantum mechanics should apply to string theory, even non-perturbatively.
particular notion of decoherence, like when you talk about a D-brain being at some position, is it maybe in a superposition or is it?
Sure. So because it's very heavy, in perturbation theory, it starts somewhere. And it only moves. You know, the wave function of a D-brain is something that is only built all about in perturbation theory. But yes, in principle, D-brains have a D-brain would have a wave function.
What can go wrong if you put a Hilbert space of string theory?
Nothing that I know. But we don't have an unperturbable definition of string theory in a cosmological setup, for example. So I cannot tell you for certainty. Yes, there is always a Hilbert space, and it always works the way it should. So we have ADS-CFT is essentially string theory in a box or quantum gravity in a box. You take a space-time which has some very peculiar boundary conditions at infinity, which is essentially a box. So everything is well behaved. And in that case, there is definitely an holographic dual, which is a quantum field theory, which has a Hilbert space, and everything is standard. And now inside this box, it's a very big box. You can do tiny experiments. So that suggests that at least for local questions, everything works. But you know, gravity is not necessarily local to an infinite degree. So I cannot guarantee that by changing the boundary conditions to infinity, you wouldn't mess up something with the formalism in a very subtle way at short distances. So I want to make a cautious statement. Let's say that there is no evidence that you need anything else besides the standard rules of quantum mechanics. But in absence of a non-perturbative definition, it's a weak statement. Okay. See you tomorrow.